Continuing the summary of The Science of Being. Gordon Brown, London, January 1975.
Well, it really gets more and more spiritually exciting the further we go with the book, doesn't it? And incidentally, there seem to be two slips of the tongue last time with the first part of the chapter when we were thinking about the part on electricity. Apparently, I said that electricity and the material forces and so on were not self-destroying, whereas, of course, as the text says, they are. And secondly, right at the end, referring to the platform, apparently I spoke of it as being at the end of the book, whereas, of course, what I meant was at the end of the chapter. So there we are, and on we go. I think it's possible, in order to do justice to this second part of the chapter, up to the platform, that possibly we will only touch on the platform tonight. Perhaps the last quarter of an hour or so, I don't know how it'll work out in terms of time, but something like that. And then, when we have studied the next chapter, some objections answered, and we come to a summary of some objections answered, so absolutely essential is it to approach that chapter, as it were, standing on the platform, that we will then take the text of the platform and the text of some objections answered all at once. I think that's a good idea because it gives us the opportunity in the meantime to ponder and ponder more the platform without committing it too soon. You like that idea? All right. Now then, that lovely thought that came or comes right at the beginning of this chapter, when we learn that as it is with Jesus, so the seed of life is really indigenous in us all and doesn't have to be planted from outside or inseminated, as it were, objectively. Not really, providing that the soil in which it grows is an honest spirituality. It's a glorious realization to come at this point in the book, I think. And after that, later on, page after page after page, stressing this fact that man is reflection. Until we find, the text tells us, that the very science of being itself is, in fact, the science of spiritual reflection. Well, that's why the seed is indigenous within us. Because, of course, man is reflection. His identity is reflection. Should we just think for a moment again of the position of the chapter within the total framework, the four square framework of the book as a whole? Consistently, it rings out the note of Christianity in its aspect as Christ, doesn't it? This 10th chapter, The Science of Being. And what does that mean? It means that every identity, every individuality in the universe, in Christianity, constituting what is called the body of the one Christ, reflects that Christ within itself. And therefore the Christ identity of us all is indigenous within us by reason of reflection. It's very, very basic, this, of course, to the chapter as a whole. And again, this then begins to tie up with where we have reached in the platform, in the chapter, namely page 306, as we come over to 307, where it is facing up to the soul, you remember last time, the soul-created forms of immortality and life, in contrast to the sex-created forms of mortality and death. And let's just be willing to face it that this is the teaching so basic to the chapter that it's either we can seem to choose between physics on the one hand, divine metaphysics on the other, and in just the same way, it's a question of sex on the one hand, or soul on the other, but really never both, says the teaching of the chapter. Well, it really does look today in the world as if this final combat between physics and metaphysics, sex and soul, is really underway. And well, it's only when the combat takes place in our own experience and how, by putting into practice the first part of the chapter, so that when we come to this series of Bible characters from now until the platform, we see that actually being illustrated as taking place in our own experience. See, we've got to be pure enough in heart to see God and stand on the platform. It's seeing God face to face. And Jacob does this, you see, in a moment after his wrestling, doesn't he? After his so-called struggle, he sees God face to face, he says. And we can face it, can't we? It is really not any longer a sex face to face, but a soul face to face proposition with which we are engaged. It's not any longer Adam inseminating Eve from outside, or even a teacher inseminating students from outside with ideas, but it is the creative, self-developing seed itself of life, truth, and love already indigenous within us and developing irresistibly. This is salvation, and this is the way the problem is worked out, as in the case of Jesus, and therefore as in Christian Science, totally, isn't it? So let's come then to the bottom of 306, where the first of these personages, or whatever you like to call them, appears, Adam. Now, I think we can just so easily realize, you see, it isn't a question of dear little Mr. and Mrs. so-and-so having been the parents of what to the senses looks like the mortal me. That's not the issue. The issue is that the Adam dream, the deep sleep, of what psychoanalysis calls today the collective or the cosmic unconscious. This is the issue, that is the single parent of all mortality and therefore of all mortal discord. It's as broad and basic the issue as that. We realize that, don't we? This so-called collective unconscious, this deep hypnotic state of sleep or dream, where mortals dream of mortality and so on. The only thing that's really unconscious is matter, the subjective state of mortal mind. And when mortal mind begins to realize that its own subjective state is inert, mindless, it yields to mind. Because the issue at the beginning of the chapter is that you can't have both. It's either mind or matter. And of course, wisdom says, it's mind. So using the rule of inversion, this is how this most fundamental idea, thought of origin, the divine, the infinite parent mind being source and origin, this is how it comes into expression, and we begin to prove that it's all matter, I beg your pardon, that it's all mind and not matter. That's right, isn't it? See, in this deep sleep, as we come up to the top of 307, it says, in which originated the delusion that life and intelligence proceeded from and passed into matter, proceeded from matter and passed into matter. Well, of course, that's the sex act with all its outcome. But what is it? It's the serpent on line 3 that we met with right at the beginning of the chapter. It's the serpent saying, ye shall be as gods, ye shall be creators in your own right, and error is as real and eternal as truth, and so on. There shall be gods many instead of one intelligence or God. Matter shall have life instead of spirit, which is the only life. See, what is the first thing in the dream that Adam dreams as soon as he's in this deep hypnotic state? What's the first thing he dreams? That Eve, that he loses his rib, isn't it? And that this rib, as soon as it is cut, the word sex is from the Latin sicere, or it's akin to the Latin sicere, to cut, that this rib, you see, as soon as it is cut away from him, and the subjective state, what is truly the subjective state of his own identity, which is his womanhood, then is made by the senses to appear to be objective out there. This is the first thing that he dreams, and immediately that he's dreaming that, then the serpent appears for the first time. Now we're going to find, when we come through to the very important illustration of Moses, of course, that he can't have a rod and a serpent at the same time. It's only when he throws down the rod that there is such a thing in belief as a serpent. If he keeps the rod in his hand, there's no serpent. If Adam would only keep his womanhood as the subjective state of his own identity, instead of having it objective out there so that he longs for something to come to him from outside of himself, instead of having the kingdom of heaven within him, and he's a house divided against himself, instead of being a kingdom united within himself, because he's reflection, and therefore everything is indigenous within him, if only he would keep to that, then of course there would be no serpent to handle. And that's the handling of the serpent. when there is no serpent to handle because of that. So he would have lost, if he allows that to happen, you see, he's lost his soul. With Jacob in a moment, we're going to find that his soul is restored to him. Adam would have lost his soul. He would have a sex mind and instead of a soul mind. Because as we come down that page to that paragraph starting line 25, where truth has no beginning, it says. It's not a thing of time, truth. But this that the psychoanalysts call the collective unconscious, which is supposed to be made up of all the mythological images and archetypes of primordial mortality, it's wholly to do with time. Primordial origins in time. But truth, this mind, this parent mind, which is the source of all consciousness and life, instead of the collective unconscious, that is of course a thing of eternity and has no beginning. Therefore, says the text, this wonderful thing on line 25, the divine mind is the soul of man. Feel these terms declaring themselves as each other, in their relationship with each other. This is so beautiful, I think, that the divine mind is the soul of man and gives man dominion over all things. It isn't man having dominion, it's God's dominion. But man has God's dominion when his mind is soul, God. Therefore, you can speak of man having dominion when his mind is soul and not sex. Because if it's sex, then he's cut up, everything is separated, and everything is at sixes and sevens and at variance with everything else. Subject here, object there, and of course there's no dominion in that case. So I love to think of soul being the mind of man, and that accounts for his having dominion over all the earth, over all that constitutes his identity. Now we can see that as the serpent whispers at the top of the page in the margin, simultaneously its opposite is at work, because you can't really have two. It's either one or the other. But simultaneously, the voice of truth is calling. And Adam has got to choose. And if he's wise, he'll choose the voice of truth and not the whispering of the serpent. But he doesn't, does he? He chooses to listen to the serpent and not really to the voice of truth, which calls out to him, where are you, consciousness? Where are you dwelling? Are you dwelling in the belief that mind is in matter? Because we're now on page 308 at the top. Adam, you see, hasn't learnt that God is the only mind governing man. He thinks he's got a mind of his own. A sex mind, that is to say, instead of a soul mind. And so he hides from the demand, and in going along with the serpent, instead of wrestling with it, he goes along with it and admits that he's looking for happiness and life in the body, but finding that the thing is an illusion, a great big hoax. That happiness and life is not to be found there. It's only to be found in the mind, which is soul. So, whereas Adam, as it were, turns from the voice of truth and listens to the whisper of the serpent, not so with Jacob. Jacob does exactly the opposite. Jacob turns from the whispering serpent and listens to the voice of truth. He chooses exactly the opposite. And therefore, Jacob is, on line 14, soul-inspired, whereas Adam is sex-inspired, isn't he? But with Jacob, he is soul-inspired. He is going to demonstrate what identity truly is, instead of the gender situation, the male-female gender, which Adam is concerned with. And what happens, you see, is that because he's soul-inspired, when he hears the voice of truth to Jacob, talking with God is not one thing and talking with man another, because there's only one identity. This is being soul-inspired. When talking with God is absolutely inseparable from talking with man, and talking with man is absolutely inseparable from talking with God. And this is being soul-inspired, when this is what we are to each other, the very voice of truth itself, and not personal voices voicing error, but the impersonal voice of truth that requires the totality of man in order to voice itself. This is soul. I think it's simply gorgeous the way this chapter is insisting on the term soul and is giving me a feeling of what is meant by the term soul that I've just never known before. Always been rather elusive. But gosh, how it's much, much clearer it is becoming. Now, Adam was alone. But when Adam was alone, he was hungering for something to come from outside to make him complete. Jacob is alone, but he's wrestling with that belief. And as he wrestles with it, struggling with the mortal sense of life, substance, intelligence as existent in matter that force pleasures, and pains an angel, truth and love, the idea of truth and love as the sole identity, the S-O-U-L, identity of everything, speaks to him, reveals itself. I am what everything truly is, truth and love. In truth and love, the manhood of God has never lost the womanhood of God. They've never been separated. Truth, they are one in truth, and that one is one in God, because truth is love. And the beautiful relationship of truth and love here is truly soul identity, isn't it? And it strikes the sinew, smites the sinew or strength of his error. Sinew is another word for nerve. You see, he isn't having this serpentine flow through the nerve concept, but the flow of life as truth and love is flowing through him and as him and filling him and constituting him, so that that's his strength. Now there is strength. Now he's got the nerve. Now he's got nerve. He's got strength. Otherwise, if he's cut up, you see, into a subject here, object there, he's weak. He's lost his true nerve. But this is the recovering of it. And he comes, therefore, face to face with truth and love, face to face with God, in this penial of divine science. He says, I see God face to face, and my life is preserved. Adam really says, I see Eve face to face, and the thing is going to be a death. It's going to result in death. But Jacob says, I see God face to face, and my life is preserved. And of course, how could it be otherwise? The day breaketh. An awakening is taking place. He's awakening from this Adam dream, and his nature is being transformed, transfigured, changed. His name is changed from Jacob to Israel. Israel, meaning he will rule as God. Think of that. Can you be humble enough? Can we be humble enough to take on this name of Israel? He will rule as God. You see, we've touched the Adam situation, now we're touching the Jacob situation, and in a moment it will be Jesus. Now, could anybody doubt that with Jesus that's the situation? He will rule as God. That means to say he won't be a personal ruler. He will rule because his mind is soul. Right? Isn't it? And that's what gives him dominion. This angel messenger, this idea that identity in soul is to be found through the two terms, truth and love. You can't name this humanly, that is to say, it's absolute. It's the absolute, and therefore you can't identify it materially. And so it's a nameless, incorporeal impartation of divine love. It's what is happening with us if we truly see what this text is teaching us. It becomes to us a nameless, incorporeal impartation of divine love. It's the impartation of divine love which says there's no parting. You can't part manhood from womanhood. You can't part man from his source, from God. That's the impartation, that there's no really any parting. It's great emphasis on soul. And it's that love which we begin to see, what this term love means, therefore, that restores Jacob's soul. It gives him back his womanhood. That which seems to be objective out there is no longer objective out there. It's the subjective state of his own identity. And in giving him back his womanhood, you can't possibly do that without giving him back to his origin, his source, giving him back to God. And so his soul is restored because his identity is restored to soul. Is found in soul. He's found his identity in soul. He says, I've seen God face to face, and the next moment he'll look out on his world, and this is preparing us for the 11th chapter, some objections answered, and he's going to say to Esau, which is his world, seemingly objective, no, I see thy face as it really is now. I see thy face as the face of God. And this is the relation of the individual to his world, whereby he'll be able to stand on the platform and answer the objections in the coming chapter. Well, it's changed the man, hasn't it? It's making him pure in heart. And the children of Israel, all of us who see the issue and are willing to face up to the issue and long to face up to the issue for our own sake, for each other's sake, for the world's sake, for God's sake. For God's sake, face up to the issue. These children are, first of all, the children of Israel, and then later on, when Jesus comes, they're renamed Christians, says this page 309, and finally, they're renamed Christian Scientists. And all they're doing in qualifying for these names is to awaken out of the Adam dream. Isn't it so? And the whole thing is the science of being at work on line 24, 309, 24. This is all the science of being, showing it's impossible for infinite spirit or soul to be in a finite body. Life never structural at the bottom there, never absorbed or limited by its own formations. No, no. Life's own formations are, we have found, soul-created formations, in contrast to the sense-created formations of mortality. Well, in that case, of course, the artist is no more in his painting, over to 310, than the potter is in his clay. Soul is not in the identity, which is the reflex image of itself. As subject reflects upon itself as object, because there's no other object to be but itself, subject. As subject reflects upon itself as object, that reflex image lives in soul, in the mind which is soul, and not vice versa. And in that case, soul is life, and everything in the universe is circulating harmoniously in relation to everything else within the systems of this divine mind, this infinite mind. So we can see, can't we, that in having his soul restored to him, Jacob's own identity is found in soul. It's restored to soul. In fact, his identity is soul itself. It's never been a human soul in a body. Never been it. Never been a human soul to have sinned and become lost, to have been cut up into a here and a there, a me and a you and a subject, object, and so on. A here and a there. No, no, the kingdom of God is within you. It isn't here, it isn't there, says Jesus. It's within you as one identity. Never lost. Soul sinless is life deathless. That's right. And that spirit, not flesh. See, by now we should be, the culture of the terms allows us to begin to feel and hear the music of them. Soul sinless, yes, that's life deathless, and that's what spirit is, that spirit, that's not flesh. And you can see the terms down at the bottom of 310, or all down that page, are really mind, spirit, and soul. Life is spirit. Spirit has no other existence than life. Well, therefore it can't lose. How can it lose itself? If spirit, soul, is life, how can it lose itself? Its life can't become extinct. And this is what we are, an awakening to be, and what Jesus understood identity to be. The sinlessness, over to 311 now, and coming down that page, it's all on the sinlessness of soul, which therefore cannot be lost. He only seemed to be lost because he believed it was a finite soul in the body. But what he did lose was a sense material, says the text. Not a sinful soul, but he lost a sense material. But his soul had never been a sinner. Therefore, he couldn't lose a sinful soul. Soul had never been lost in the mortal body. So what he lost was a sense of sin. And this is the understanding, says the text, of the science of being, the law of deathless life, is the law of sinless soul. You see, now where is it now? The objects, yes, on line 26, cognized by the physical senses. The objects cognized by the physical senses have got to become to us what they are in the science of being. Not what they seem to be to the physical senses, but what they are in the science of being, namely, the subjective state of our very own mind, spirit, soul. That's all there is, or what there is, to the objects cognized by the physical senses. And, of course, in beginning to awaken to that, we are using the rule of inversion that featured so much last time, didn't it? Not objects cut off out there. They're just sense dreams, and that's what is lost. Reversed. So that what they become to us are the spiritual facts of being in science. That's 312 on line 3. They become to us, these seeming objects of sense, become to us the spiritual facts of being in science when we are using that rule of inversion. And as we come down that page 312, We can see Jesus, the section on Jesus coming at the bottom of the page. But in the middle there, look at the terms principle, love, truth, life. Principle, impersonal principle in operation as love, truth, life, instead of the vain personal ecstasies of mortals. All the terms are here, you see, in the science of being. Mind, spirit, soul, just back there. Principle, the order, love, truth, life. Our mind being soul, you see, no vain personal ecstasies, and therefore, realizing that, we can come to consider the section on Jesus. And immediately, on line 31, what is it? Spiritual origin. Not origin in this collective unconscious, this deep sleep and dream of mortality and sex and division. No, says Jesus, I don't originate there. My origin is spirit. I'm a spiritual origin. And that's true, of course, for my world, because it couldn't be true for me if it wasn't true for my world. And that's what I'm going to prove. And so it's the spiritual origin, instead of sex origin, that's what demonstrates principle and entitles us to sonship in science at the bottom of the page. Entitling us to sonship in science instead of sonship in material sense. Do you remember in last time in the first part of the chapter that most useful, helpful, to me very, very helpful illustration of the wall that doesn't let the light through and the window pane that does let the light through, but most important of all, the light itself. Do we remember that? Well, of course, we're just seeing it illustrated. Adam is like the wall, it doesn't let the light through. Jacob is the beautiful, becomes increasingly the transparent window pane that lets the light through, the light, it says so, of truth and love. And he finds his identity, therefore, to be the light. But Jesus knows from the beginning that his identity is the light, not the window pane and certainly not the wall. And so these three weld together to form a single beautiful compound idea, don't they? You don't think of Adam as a person and Jacob as a person and then Jesus as another person. It's a glorious idea that's being unfolded. So we find ourselves, the opposite of losing ourselves, we find our identity to be the light spiritually, like the third degree, the opacity of the physical first degree, in that case, yields to a temporary human transparency, second degree, until that transparency is found to be pure reflection. That is to say, the light itself issuing forth as the first translation coming from God, first translation in operation, that is to say, man of spiritual origin. You see the translations at work, no doubt about it, is there? And therefore, that's the human and the divine being one in divine science. So as we come over the page, of course it must be virgin. He was the son of a virgin. That means to say he is a soul creation instead of a sex creation. His life is a soul-created form. Nothing's going to destroy it. It's appearing humanly, and nothing can any more destroy it humanly than it can divinely, and it certainly can't destroy it divinely, because he's working in divine science where the human and the divine are one in identity. He's found his identity in soul, Jesus. And this is true through the ministry of the science of being in the lives of each one of us and in the thought and consciousness of each one of us. It is destined to be true for us too in Christian science. Look at the way the terms appear on line 2 there. Christ Jesus, that's the divine human. Christ Jesus, that's the first translation indicated. And then secondly, Jesus the Christ. There's the human being restored to the divine as the reflection of the divine. And if you like, it's the human, the Greek, being properly translated, so that all there is Christ, Jesus, Jesus the Christ, the divine, the human, the divine, this circulation of life. And you can see how Jesus is the very light itself and knows himself to be the light because he is the brightness of God's glory. He is the outpouring of the glory, that is to say, the light that is infinite at source. The source of it is infinite. That's the glory of it. It is impossible to use it up. It's infinite. And he is the light itself, the brightness, the shining forth of it, as the expressed on line 11, image of infinite mind. That's it. That's the light, isn't it? The expressed image of infinite mind being translated character. The character of infinite mind, our mind destined to be infinite in character. The character of it is in every way infinite, this God mind of ours, which is soul. Infinite resources within, never anything without, all within. And so Christ on line 16, the Son of God. This Christ is the Son of God in contrast to Jesus on line 18, who is the Son of Mary, little s, Son of Mary, capital S, Son of God. Not even the Son of Man, because when the phrase Son of Man comes, and that comes in the platform, doesn't it? Actually is referred to there in the platform when it's all resolved. The Son of Man, in that case, is capital S, very different from Mary's son, little s. But unless Mary had realized that her identity really was man in the generic sense, woman, in the truly generic sense, Jesus would never have appeared. And you see him as the scientist. This is being the scientist in the margin at the bottom there. What constitutes him the scientist? That he plunges beneath the material surface of things and finds the spiritual cause. Every scientist in the physical sense is seeking to do the same thing, to plunge beneath the surface. Let's get to see what the atom really consists of, or the microbiology, or whatever it is. Or psychoanalysis. Let's plunge beneath the surface and find the spiritual cause. Well, of course, all that is counterfeit, and in divine science, it must be so in the science of being. And what happens as he does this? It's salvation to him to do it. Because it isn't really that he plunges down into the deep divinity of being or into the spiritual cause, and then as a result of that he comes up out of the grave. Not really. It's a simultaneous happening. In the measure that you and I come out from the Father, come up out of the depths of the infinite, in that measure we are certainly, humanly speaking, coming up out of the grave of belief of life in matter, not as two things happening, but as one happening. Never two things in the science of being. And I feel so sure, you see, that this is what we are touching, beginning to touch in this attitude towards the text. If we can truly plunge beneath the surface reading into the deep, deep divinity of it, not as a text, but as the Word of God, as truth, then it will raise us from mortality, so that the dream will begin to disappear. And what are we doing in that case? It's resurrection. It's resurrection over to page 314. It's resurrection leading to final translation or ascension. So it says there how he found the eternal ego. Do you remember that back a few pages or a number of pages before, the eternal ego, where the ego man is the reflection of, inseparable from, the ego God. And so it's all the time it's reaching the solution of being. But what does it amount to? Just one thing, basically, demonstrating one mind, demonstrating that we are of one mind and we're not cut up into God's many, Lord's many, creative gods, minds many, souls many, spirits many, and so on and so on. The whole thing is the demonstration of the oneness of mind, the uncut upness of infinite mind. You see, it looks in the middle of that page 314 like the rebuilding with Jesus of a flesh and bones body that's been destroyed. But mind, this one mind is the builder. And what is this one mind doing in that instance? It's reproducing its own one body, because it can't do otherwise. It must do, because the source being infinite, the outcome, the output is infinite. It is always reproducing itself, but we see it individualized. It's still the one mind and the one body, but it's individualized, individually reflected in the instance of Jesus there and in the instance of each one of us in Christian Science. And what is being brought to light down there on line 21 is therefore the true idea of life and substance. Right here, humanly, all there is to us is the true idea of life and substance, and the faithful Mary, the Mary state of consciousness, sees it. It penetrates the senses and sees the reality. That's Mary. Well, in the bottom paragraph on 314, you can see him. It's a continuous demonstration of divine science. Human and divine never cut away from each other. And it carries, it says, the problem of being, this continuous demonstration, higher and higher. It's simply according to the demands of the divine principle. It's the divine principle, truth and love, which is demanding this, that truth and love is exactly the same angel idea as speaks to Jacob, isn't it? Working out the problem of being for Jacob, working out the problem of being for Jesus, working out the problem of being for you and me. Namely, what? Man's inseparability from God, the inseparability and consequence of his manhood from his womanhood, subject and object. Can you see that it's all the identity of the individual, that's life, and his world, universally, love, that's what truth is. This is the Lord life. And of course, as the text says down there, it's odious to sinners. It's odious to the belief that everything is cut up into bits and pieces, because that's sinners. Feel it with Jesus, you see. What seems to be objective out there is to Jesus subjective. It's the subjective state of his own God-mind. I feel the salvation in this somehow. I long to see it, truly see it more and more clearly. But we can just be grateful that something is speaking. And if we turn over now to 315, we find that his ego is this one mind in divine science, even if it is anathema to scholastic theology, which of course it is. scholastic theology, wanting to have a mind of its own. The ego is the one mind in divine science for each one of us. And as we come down that page 315, we will have the caption, Immaculate Conception, which means to say we are never allowed for a moment to leave the idea of spiritual origin. I'm sure we all remember in the Atonement and Eucharist chapter those beautiful passages and descriptions of Mary, how she was in self-conscious communion with God. Can you see her thought yielding up the personal, her identity really being woman, which is man in the generic sense, like the woman in the Apocalypse. And as she does that, you see she's conceiving the true idea of God in that case as the only author of man. And that brings forth Jesus at that point of the development, because it's necessary for Jesus to be brought forth then. Today it's Christian Science. And therefore, to human sense, Jesus appeared now at the bottom of 315, appeared part human and part divine, and as such a mediator. He's the mediator between spirit and the flesh. And if we turn over 316, this becomes, he points out the way, therefore, of divine science, the way of the human and the divine, always inseparable, always in coincidence, as the one and only way. There's no other way. It's the way of salvation for all. And today, that is being linked on line four, being linked by science, man being linked by science to his maker. Science links us to our infinite source, so that our mind becomes in every way infinite instead of finite. But the science is the link, and Jesus demonstrated in his own being that link, mediatorial link. And so he represented Christ on line 12, the true idea of God, the indestructible man. And look at this man on line 20, 21, this indestructible man. He's spirit created. He's not sex created. He's spirit created. He's spirit constituted. He's not matter constituted. And he's spirit governed. He's not serpent governed. And this tremendous term, Christ, then, illustrates that blending with God, his divine principle, which gives man dominion over all the earth. Christ is that wherein we find mind to be God, soul, which gives dominion over all the earth. That's why he has dominion, because his mind is soul and not sense or sex. And of course it's always been true, as we come over to 317. The foundation of the world sexually, materially, seems to have hidden it. But it hasn't done anything to it. It's always true. Secret from the foundation of the world, since material knowledge usurped the throne of the principle. But nevertheless, it's always been true. And all he's doing, and all this book is doing, and all we're doing at this instant, is to utter that which has been secret from the foundation of the world, but always true. Isn't it so? Well, to live this life is to declare the power of Christian Science, the power of it. You see, your power in Christian Science lies in the fact that the power lies in oneness. All the power of Christian Science lies in the power of divine science. That's where the power of Christian Science lies, in divine science, because divine science is that aspect of science which is science utterly indivisible, unbreakable. And that's where the power of everything we do in Christian Science comes from. If the world hate you, ye know that it hated me, for it hated you. I am with you alway, not only in all time, but in all ways and conditions. Divine Science is saying to us, I, Divine Science, am with you, Christian Science, in every possible undertaking. You have at the back of you the power of the oneness and wholeness of everything in divine science at the back of everything that you do in detail or specifically in Christian Science. And because of this, we are still on line 16 concerned basically with what individuality is as indivisibility. This is where individuality as indivisibility really takes on meaning. The understanding of the spiritual individuality of man. This is what it is. You see, the understanding of his spiritual individuality. That's his indivisibility in the divine science of being. It's that that enabled the self-same Jesus to appear to the disciples after the resurrection as before. Nothing had touched him. Nothing was changed. His real identity, says the text, being spirit, soul, Jesus showed Thomas that he was unchanged by the crucifixion. That's absolute Christian Science. Unchanged. You can't do anything about it. Nothing can touch it, either divinely or humanly. And so Christian Science remains what it always is, absolute. Same before as after. The before is when he showed it at the Transfiguration. That enabled him to meet the crucifixion and come to the resurrection. Therefore, he is exactly the same at the resurrection as he is at the Transfiguration, and nothing has touched him. Now, let's just pause for a moment, and we'll turn the tape over and then carry on, shall we?